Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guest today is Colette Colligan, the author of A Publisher's Paradise, Expatriate Literary Culture in Paris, 1890 to 1960. And the book has just come out with the University of Massachusetts Press in 2014. Hi there, Colette.
Hi there.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. I'm happy to talk about my book. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could get us started by telling our listeners a little bit more about yourself and how you came to the subject of this book.
Okay. Well, I'm an English literature professor at Simon Fraser University, and I've been researching the history of pornography for a number of years since I wrote my dissertation. And I found myself, when on sabbatical in Paris, at the Bibliothèque Nationale de France, and I was struck by the number of English language books that were in the library that were of a pornographic nature and from the 19th century. And I was expecting to find French language books or English language books that had been imported from Britain. But in fact, what I found were all these English language books published in Paris. And that was basically what started me on this research path to look into the history of English language publication in Paris from around the late 19th century. And thus the book was born.
And you're a scholar of print culture and publishing in general. That's something that's a sort of angle on this literary production that you take it in your work as a whole. Is that right, Colette?
Yes. And I don't know. I don't think I began this project really with a view to exploring publishing history. I began this project with a completely different question. I don't even know if I remember what the initial question was anymore, but it certainly wasn't, I wasn't interested in publishing history. And it all began with me discovering these English language books, in particularly the Enfer collection, which is the Hell collection of the Bibliothèque Nationale.
I didn't even know about this collection. I wonder if you could just say a little bit more about it, like what the parameters are and what else is in this collection. And I think some of our listeners would be interested to know more about it if they haven't heard about it already.
Oh, sure. Well, the Enfer collection was a collection that was started in the Napoleonic era. And it contains the forbidden books of France. And it includes mostly French language books, of course, and the collection is quite diverse. I mean, it contains a lot of de Sade, for instance, and other controversial and banned French writers. But it also contains foreign language books that were circulating through Paris, and because Paris was a important center of distribution of these kinds of books anyway. And so it does contain a good number of foreign language books. And what I discovered was that there were a number of these English language books that started appearing around the 1890s that were published from Paris. So they weren't imported or anything like that. They were actually published in Paris. And so they were circulating alongside some of these banned French books sometimes by the same publishers, through the same bookstores, and so on. And I think the reason why I got into exploring the publishing history behind these books is that I just became fascinated with how these books started appearing in Paris and getting circulated in Paris, because I didn't know why. I didn't know how they got there. And what I had read by a bibliographer on 19th century pornography moving into the 20th century in the English language is that in 1910, the production or the publication of English language pornography in Britain had stopped. Hmm. And I was struck by this, and I was wondering why it had stopped. And then when I put that insight together with the fact that I was seeing all of this English language pornography coming out of Paris from the 1890s and onwards, I realized, oh, well, what we have here is not this, not an absence of this kind of production, but simply a relocation, of this kind of production. And that relocation involved, in many instances, the relocation of people, people who were driven out of Britain and set up shop in Paris.
Well, and there's so much in this story that's fascinating to me and that I want to ask you about. And I know that, you know, when we talked about doing this interview, we talked about whether this was technically a French studies project or a French studies book. And to my mind, for exactly the reasons that you've laid out, it absolutely is, because Paris is the center of what you're talking about. And there is definitely a French cultural dimension to the publication and distribution of these texts. There's something about the history of the city and the history of culture in that city, you know, from the late 19th century through the middle of the 20th century that I think makes this a definitively French studies project in some ways, or at least the way that I define that. So when and how, I guess this is the big question that we'll talk about through the course of the interview, but when and how does Paris become then this, what you call, and I'm quoting you here, a secret publishing haven for English pornography?
Well, I date it around 1890, and for a number of reasons. And some of those factors include a crackdown in Britain on what was considered obscene publication. And what that meant was that certain publishers who were putting out, say, translations of French novels, or just putting out underground English language novels, original English language novels, those publishers were being put in prison. There's a famous case of this French publisher called Henri Visitali, who was in London, who tried to put out a translation, an unexpurgated translation of Zola's works, who was found guilty of obscenity and had to serve 2 years hard labor in prison. That was in the late 1880s. And a number of other cases like that followed, involving publishers who were based in London. And so by 1890, and then throughout the 1890s, publishers just found it increasingly difficult to operate in London, and were looking for an escape route. And sometimes they were fleeing from the law. They had been charged, and they actually just fled from London to Paris and set up shop again. And so that was one factor. So basically, British obscenity laws were enforced. They were already in place, but they were really enforced around that period. And another factor was the fact that Paris had much more relaxed laws around the publication of books. And in fact, books were protected from charges of immorality or obscenity. So there were laws against obscenity in France, or what was called outrage contre bonne mère. There were laws against that, but they applied particularly to works that were not books. And the book was all but exempt. So the book could be prosecuted only in the very highest court. And it was rarely prosecuted after 1881. There were only a handful of cases of a book being prosecuted from about 1881 to 1913, just before World War I. And so what that meant was that the book was pretty much free. Its publication was pretty much free in France, and Paris being the capital of this of publication, and the cultural capital that attracted foreigners in particular, it meant that these people could set up shop in France and not be persecuted in the way that they were in Britain. And so those are a couple of factors that explain how this publishing refuge started up. In some ways, I'm making the argument that British laws were more censorious and French laws around publication were more liberal. And that's a fairly standard argument that can be made. But what I do try to do is look more closely at the lives of these publishers and booksellers in Paris and the ways in which, in fact, they were monitored. They weren't completely free to operate without regulation. They were, in fact, monitored and regulated as well. And sometimes that was through, or sometimes that was by the police, who were instructed by the Minister of Interior, who was getting information from the British government. And sometimes it was by the local police, who didn't like the kinds of people who would be attracted to a particular bookshop, for instance.
I know, and I'm going to want to ask you some more about the kind of history of this and as it changes from this long period that you cover from 1890 to 1960. But before I do, there are a couple of things that I just want to talk about before we get into the real meat of the book. And there are two things. One, I won't never forgive myself if I don't ask you about the personal thing that brought you to reading pornography in the Bibliothèque Nationale and to thinking about some of these issues, which is that you have this kind of, you talk about this in the introduction, that you have a kind of personal entry into working on these issues and thinking about this illicit literature. And I wonder if you could tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Sure. So as I write about in my introduction, I was raised in a fairly unorthodox household, I guess, where my mother had her own business, which was a sex shop. And this was in Vancouver, and it was called The Love Nest. And some of my earliest memories were, of course, at The Love Nest, where I would go after school and even do book work sometimes. And I do remember all sorts of awkward feelings that I had being in my parents' shop, and also awkward feelings about entering the shop and exiting the shop, because sometimes I would get comments from adults who were passing by or looking in the window about how I shouldn't be near the shop and it wasn't for me. So I remember all of those sensations around the shop. Mm-hmm. And I also remember my parents sold everything. They sold lingerie, they sold sex toys, and they sold books as well. And I remember quite vividly the experience of looking at these books. And then once, I guess, I was reading more regularly, reading these books, I guess that just stuck with me. And as I continued in my studies in literature, I realized that this was really a domain of interest, looking at illicit literature, erotic literature. And then that interest really evolved into publishing history. Who were the people behind this work? And I think maybe even that question came from my personal experience of knowing what motivated my parents to run this business and some of the concerns they had and some of the interactions they had with other parents who had children and so on. So yeah, that's probably where it started, I'm sure.
Well, I had to ask you about it because I was sort of reading along the beginning of the book, and then I read this kind of personal sort of, you're revealing this personal history that connects you to this subject matter. And I was surprised by it. And it was also so fascinating. I felt like I had to ask you about it. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, Colette, is that, you know, the way that you're reading all of this. So if it's informed by some of your personal history, you're also bringing some theoretical and historical, you know, you've got a certain approach to this material and to this history. And the two concepts that I'd like you to say a little bit more about before we go on to talk about the three main parts of the book and the chapters of the book are these two concepts. And one is this idea of culture ghost, and the other is this notion of recognizability that you're using to work through this history and these ideas. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about what those things mean and how you're using them in the book.
Okay. And I see both of those concepts as connected and in how they inform my approach to the material and my discussion of the material. A culture ghost was coined by this Victorian author called Vernon Lee, who is known as Vernon Lee. And she describes it as that kind of influence that overcomes somebody at a particular moment, and the kind of influence that one isn't necessarily able to control completely. A kind of influence that that can be pervasive as well. And of course, she's connecting that to culture. And so some aspect of culture that is pervasive, that is not fully manifest, but that is latent, and that overcomes one, that influences one in sometimes imperceptible and sometimes utterly incontrollable ways. And I use that concept maybe in two ways. First of all, to talk about my own fascination with some of the figures that I study. Mm-hmm. So one big discovery was this publisher named Charles Carrington, and I see him and his vision of culture as a kind of a culture ghost for me, because I'm absolutely fascinated by this man and what he achieved and how he viewed culture. And even as I'm fascinated by him, I kind of wonder why sometimes, because he's also fairly reprehensible. He's certainly on the margins of respectability in some ways, and recuperability, cultural recuperability, because some of his thinking is quite reprehensible. So I use that concept to inform my interest in certain figures and that kind of problematic interest. Hmm. And I also use it simply to talk about, just more generally, to talk about those remnants of culture that are latent, but then can become manifest through historical inquiry and scholarly inquiry. So that's how I think of Culture Ghost. Through Vernon Lee. Mm-hmm. And I also, tied to that, is this notion of recognizability. And that's a notion of Walter Benjamin, the Marxist scholar, the German Marxist scholar. And I don't consider myself a Marxist, but I do latch on to his term recognizability, because it's part of his concept of an approach to history. And he sees our relationship to history as very much a dialectic between now and then, and that our recovery of history is always changing and happening in the present, in the now. And it is in the now, in a changing now, that we might recognize something valuable about the past, but it's a very particular moment, and that recognizability is thus very contingent on the now, on the conditions of the now. And that's also how I've been talking about how I've been doing this history. I came to it because of my interest in pornographic literature. So that kind of that made me focused on this kind of literature and asking questions about that kind of literature that another person might not have come to and asked. And I came to this history of this publishing haven in Paris, partly because of the fact that I was in Paris doing my research. And if I had been doing my research not in Paris, but say in Britain, I wouldn't have noticed recognized that there were these English language books in a foreign library. If I were in Britain, that probably would have escaped my notice. Working with the Enfer collection, imagining that I'd be mostly seeing French language books and books published in Paris, and then seeing these English language books against these French language books, that is what I would describe as a moment of recognizability that it was absolutely possible because of my dislocation at that particular moment and because of my own research interests. That's how I think about recognizability and how it informs my approach to history.
I've read a number of books, you know, call it doing these interviews and reading yours and thinking about these echoes, you know, both in terms of when you refer back to your childhood experiences, but also, you know, that whole idea of you're writing about these expats and this literary production that is expatriate literary production, but your process of coming to the material and thinking through these questions was also to some extent this kind of experience of dislocation and and relocation. And I find those echoes really fascinating. And I think it's one of the things that we don't often get to talk about as scholars, how our ideas come to us through these intellectual threads of reading and then thinking about where we're going to go, but also these very visceral and material kinds of relocations and movements that as you say, that's really fascinating to me, this idea that wouldn't have struck you had you not been sitting in the French National Library.
No, and it was a long period of dislocation for me because I was on my sabbatical and it's 16 months and it happened fairly early in that 16 months. But the idea didn't strike me right away. I remember, I don't remember the exact moment that I was thinking, what are these English language books doing here? But I do remember I had that question and that was lingering for a while. And it was because I was dislocated and for a period of time that idea could germinate and then develop. And then also I had the time to explore these expatriate routes of publication in Paris. So it was my own expatriation that really led me to this subject. And also subsequently, I mean, I know this isn't what we're going to focus on today, but subsequently my interest in expatriate lives and literature in Paris during this period, because it's just opened my eyes to all the other kinds of expatriate experiences at this time. And for instance, there were a number of English language newspapers in the 19th century being published out of Paris. The BNF has something like 190 different English language newspapers from the 19th century into the beginning of the 20th century. And I just find that fascinating. And I would never have thought of looking into that press, that history of the press otherwise.
Yeah, it's really fascinating that the way in which that notion of the expat life, community, you know, cultural literary production is so much at the, it's a central feature of Parisian culture, especially, I mean, French culture maybe generally, but especially of culture in that city, which is why this history is such an important part of the history of the city from the late 19th century through the mid 20th. So let's move on to talk about the sort of three main parts of the book that you've got here. So there's the three sections of the book: politics, publication, and pornography. And of course, the story that you're telling from the late 19th century through up to 1960. There are connections between these categories and sections of the book, but you divide it into these sections. So the first section that you've already sort of touched on a little bit deals with, and I'm quoting you here, the complex political dynamics behind the rise and fall of these Paris editions, right, of these English language books. And so this is really, it's one of the kind of fascinating things about the book is the way you've organized it. Sort of this is the part of the book that really focuses on the kind of legal history and cultural policy and the interaction of these things with the publication history. So maybe you could sort of sketch out for us, you know, you've got these two chapters in this section, one that deals with the late 19th century up to the First World War, and then the second one that deals with the period after the First World War right up to 1960. So what happens in this history of politics and cultural policy across this period? What changes over time? And, you know, maybe you could also come back to this idea of, you know, it's not so simple as Anglo repression, French freedom. There's something more complicated going on here.
So I should say this was the most difficult part of the book for me to write. on politics because I'm not trained as a historian. But I was dealing with government archives, and especially I was dealing with legislation and the kinds of materials that are not used as often by literary scholars as they are by historians. And I also struggled in some ways to write these chapters. In fact, I rewrote these chapters a number of times in order to try to get out this history of what was happening in Britain and what was happening in France that led to the creation of this publishing haven and then eventually its dissolution. And the first chapter is where I talk mostly about British censorship and the crackdown, as I've talked about earlier with you. And then subsequently, the ways in which the British government tried to police some of these publishers who were popping up in Paris. And so what I found was that the British government was closely monitoring the operations of these Paris publishers because they realized pretty quickly that they had relocated to Paris and were sending material to Britain through the post largely. And so what happened, as revealed in Home Office papers and letter correspondence, for instance, is that the British government began secretly monitoring the post and opening up letters. And this was, of course, highly questionable. Mm-hmm. And Home Office lawyers were even questioning this practice of opening private people's mail because mail was protected. But nonetheless, this was going on for a very long time. And this correspondence is fascinating because it is there that you discover who some of these people were in Paris and how they were operating and how they were operating through the post. But you also get insight to the ways in which the Home Office developed this cultural policy of they arguably illegally opening private mail. And then even more interestingly, opening up diplomatic conversations with other countries about foreign publishers who were importing, exporting this kind of material through Paris. And Britain essentially became a kind of global watchdog of an increasingly internationalized pornography trade, but all secretly, kind of outside the purview of courts and so on. And so I basically track the way in which the British government cracks down on these publishers and then begins to monitor them and opens up diplomatic channels to monitor them more globally. And I explain how this kind of first censorship and then monitoring ultimately led to the rise of the trade in Paris in particular, because Paris, because of its more liberal laws of the press, enabled pornographers to operate out of there a little bit more easily, say, than other locations, even if it's Brussels or something like that. And so I try to show how, ironically, this publishing haven was very much a British creation. And so I talk about that, and that's where I really track what's going on 1890s to 1930s and the political dynamics and cultural policies that gave rise to this publishing phenomenon that I'm talking about. And then I move into just what's happening in a later moment where we know much more about publishing in Paris, English language publishing in Paris, in the 1920s, of course, because that's when Works like Ulysses were published out of Paris, and everybody knows about that, and how Sylvia Beach, the American, published for the first time his Ulysses from Paris.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do is I try to track what's happening in the 1920s as well, and the 1930s, and then even after World War II, with English language publication in Paris, and track the ways in which government, the ways in which laws, but also government policies changed during that period to still facilitate this, or still kind of facilitate's not the right word, but to still enable this kind of publishing phenomenon in Paris, but then also gradually lead to its decline. And one argument I make is that more censorious laws were introduced in France around foreign language publication, mm-hmm. leading up to in the period leading up to World War I. And so there were laws against foreign language publication published in Paris that was considered injurious or seditious. But that law could have been applied more broadly as well. And that was, of course, to police fascist thought in Paris, but mm-hmm. that law remained on the books. And also there was just a less liberal government, of course, after World War II as well, that initiated new laws that eventually meant that Paris was no longer the necessary place to publish these kinds of books. And at the same time, Britain and America, their own laws around obscenity were drastically changing. And so what I try to do in this section on politics is just explain this phenomenon by tracking what's happening, legally speaking, but also just by governments and kind of backdoor exchanges that are happening through diplomatic channels.
So just to clarify for me, Colette, and for our listeners, that is there a dispute between the French and British government over this? Like, is there a kind of stop sending these books to Britain and no, we won't because we're French and we just won't?
That's a good question. And it's a complicated one because the first answer is yes. In some ways. So the British government would send some kind of letter. Okay. Can you monitor this person? And, Ministry of Interior would contact the police, and a police person would contact the publisher and basically say nothing can be done. It's not infringing on French laws.
Mm-hmm.
And that was frequently the response happening in the early period, so 1890s, beginning of the 20th century. So that was frequently the response. But then there were also more local responses to pornography, and also English, especially foreign language pornography. And so you'd have parents writing to the mayor about how they didn't want these kinds of publications and these kinds of stores visible in the streets for their children to see. Hmm. And so there was a more local response that wasn't as liberal, right?
Right.
About these kinds of publications. And the work that Brooke Blower has been influential to me. Her book is called Becoming Americans in Paris. And she has in fact tracked down a lot of this correspondence. This especially happening in the 1920s and 1930s when a lot of American tourists are coming to Paris. And she tracks down a lot of this local reaction to these tourists, but then also the businesses that feed these tourists and how they are ruining neighborhoods and so on, and associating Paris with vice and immorality, and ruining Paris and then France's reputation internationally. And so that's also the story that I try to bring out in that first section.
Hmm. It's fascinating because it does mess with some of those kind of tropes and stereotypes of French culture and, you know, the whole French population somehow being more open to sexuality, explicit literature, pornography, that kind of characterization that is also a kind of foreign imposition onto French culture as this sort of more liberal, freewheeling culture when it comes to sexuality. So in the second part of the book, you really focus on the publishing, and you've got these terms that, I mean, they're probably known to people who work on publishing history, but you know, you talk about booklegging and book laundering. I don't know if these are your terms or where they, but I was taking notes, I put several exclamation marks next to these thinking, oh, what concepts. I'd never thought about these things in those ways. And so the second part of the book is more of this kind of commercial side and the, what you refer to as a social history. And this is the part of the book where you really get into, you know, the figure you've already mentioned, Charles Carrington. So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about him and, you know, why his story is so important, why his career is so important, and why he plays such a central role in the book.
Sure. And I should say, so what I do with this book is I have my three sections, and in each of these sections, I'm driven by different kinds of materials, historical materials. So in this publishing section, I'm looking at books. I'm looking at whatever archives I can find from these publishers. And there are no intact archives. It's a letter here, a letter there. Mm-hmm. And then just discussions around their businesses. So it's a different set of historical documentation that I work with in each of my sections. And I basically, in this section on publishing, begin in the 1890s again and move to my later period. And so I retell my story using a different set of documents and asking a different set of questions. Mm-hmm. So in the politics section, I'm really interested mostly in the regulation of this material. In the publishing section, I'm really interested in the business people who are behind this and the businesses that they cobbled together. And that's what drives me through the second section. And I, at the heart of this section on publishing is the figure of Charles Carrington, who I basically say is the person who really established this interest in the Paris edition and who was the father of this publishing phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And his story is really fascinating. And people who have studied 19th century pornography will know his name. But beyond those circles, and that circle is pretty small, beyond those circles, he's not really well known. And I really hope my book will make him a better known cultural figure, because I think some of the cultural work he was doing was really fascinating. And I knew a little bit about him going into the project, and over about the 3 years of research, I discovered a bit more and filled in some blanks. And one of the most interesting discoveries was what he was doing when he was young, when he was in London, because he was a Londoner. He was born in London. He was an Anglo-Jew, and he came from a fairly large family. He didn't have much education. Bibliographers have shown some evidence about how he got into the book trade, but why he was in London and then set up shop in Paris as a publisher has never really been known. And at one point in my research, I discovered that he was in London as a young man working as I think you just call him a stockbroker. Mm. And he was buying selling stocks to interested buyers, but it was all fraudulent. He was just taking their money and actually not investing it anything. And he was thus called in the period a bucket shop runner. So he got money and just put it in a bucket and did nothing else with it. He didn't actually buy stocks. And his brothers were involved in this business, and they were eventually caught, charged, and put in prison for a couple of years. And it seems pretty likely that Carrington, whose original name was Paul Ferdinando, that Carrington was going to be charged and on his way and put into prison as well. And so he fled London to Paris, renamed himself Charles Carrington, seemed to have a bucket of money from his bucket shop running days, and set up shop in Paris. And there were other publishers in Paris who put out original English language books, but they were few and far between. There's been a little bit of research on this, but it was he who really invented this brand of the Paris edition. And he put out translations of French novels. English translations of French novels. Mm-hmm. He put out original English books, some of which were pornographic, some of which were a little bit more literary. And the important thing to know about him is that it was always a bit of both. Some of it's pornography, some of it's more literary. He was one of the first people to translate into English Anatole France, for instance. Mm. And so as a cultural figure, really at the heart of English language cultural exchange, I think he should be recognized in a way that he hasn't been recognized before. And he was also the publisher who put out Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray after no British publisher would touch it. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I talk a lot about his biography, his business practices, how he really viewed culture, literary culture, in an innovative way, insofar as he really saw himself as somebody who was working against censorship, and was able to understand how there was value in pornographic, marginal, corrupt parts of culture. There was value in that, and that shouldn't be censored, that shouldn't be banned, and that should be something that is talked about. And I think another aspect of his thought that I find interesting is that he mixed high and low. Mm-hmm. So he put out really terrible, terrible literature in all the senses that you can imagine, alongside really highbrow literature that was a little bit more recognized. But he was interested in that kind of cultural leveling and those cultural impurities. And even talked about this in some of his writing. And so I talk about his business. I talk about how he influenced and to some extent worked with some other publishers. And then in the last chapter on publishing, I move into establishing one of the other main claims of my book, which is that I'm not just talking about pornographic publication in Paris that's happening, English language pornographic publication that's happening 1890s, beginning of the 20th century. I'm also talking about how that is linked to the high modernist mm-hmm. publishing that is happening in Paris and that is more talked about in the 1920s and later on. And I look at the ways in which Carrington was and his business and his business practices and his cultural thought were linked in very material, but in other ways as well, to publishers like Sylvia Beach, who is behind the publication of Ulysses, or Jack Kahane, who is behind the publication of Henry Miller's novels, mm-hmm. The Tropic of Cancer, and so on. And so I try to trace some of those publishing and distribution connections between those peddlers of pornography and those high modernist cultural figureheads.
It's one of the things that I found most compelling about the book is sort of, yes, there is this kind of fascination with the the dirty books that you're dealing with and how you came upon this material and how you got interested in it, and then the sort of illicit publication networks and censorship and all of these issues. But that, and I think you put it this way, you say, you talk about exploring these connections between the most degraded and the most reputable modernist novels. That's the way you put it. And I think situating this history in relationship to that perhaps better known history of modernist literary production, especially in Paris, but not only in Paris, but especially in Paris during this period, is one of the things that I found most compelling about the book. And it kind of takes us pretty naturally into this last part of the book where you talk about, where you focus more on pornography, that becomes the lens of the third part of the book. And you focus on the books themselves. And we probably don't have time to talk about all of them, but you talk about these three texts, Suburban Souls, and is it Telani?
Telani. Yeah,
a work that has been attributed to Wilde. And then you talk about Lolita. As a fan of the novel for many years, I was really, really fascinated by this Parisian story and this dimension to that novel. So I wonder if you could perhaps use that as an example, or one of the other two, to give us a sense of what's going on in this third part of the book, and how you're working with the books themselves in this section to come at the story in a different way.
Yeah. Okay. So just quickly, what I'm trying to do in this last section is, as you say, talk about the books themselves and in a very close and detailed way. And because in the other chapters, I'm not doing any kind of more close literary analysis. Mm-hmm. So in this last chapter, I want to take a closer look at these books, both the more disreputable books. So that would be the novels like Suburban Souls, which was an underground novel that involves pseudo incest. Mm-hmm. And also Telani, which is sometimes labeled the first gay novel, and as you said, attributed to Oscar Wilde, and connect those more disreputable pornographic novels from the earlier part of my study to one of the most respected novels from 1955, Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita. Mm-hmm. And so I pair these novels very deliberately in order to establish those connections between the early part of this history of this publishing haven and the very later part, and to make that connection between the pornographic and what is then later considered far more literary and far more respectable, in ways that, and I hope that pairing will seem discomforting to some people. Mm-hmm. It's intended to be discomforting. Mm-hmm. But I try to, when I talk about Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita, I talk about the way in which Lolita came to be published and the way in which Nabokov really tried to manage its publication. And just to briefly discuss this, maybe I should mention what Lolita is about in case some people haven't read.
Sure, yeah.
Lolita is a novel that was quite controversial because it involves a middle-aged gentleman, Humbert's, obsession with a prepubescent young girl, Lolita. And eventually he does, in fact, rape her and seduces her, and there's a story that follows from that. And he couldn't find a publisher for it for a long time. I mean, it took him about 5 years to write it. He knew that the material would be difficult to publish. Mm-hmm. He couldn't find a publisher at that point in his life. He was based in the States teaching at Cornell. He couldn't find a publisher for it among the New York publishers. And so went to Paris. And of course, Sylvia Beach, the publisher of Ulysses, was no longer publishing. He maybe had her kind of as a possibility, or that model of publication as a possibility, but he ended up getting published by a much less reputable publisher, Maurice Girardius, who had put out books like, I don't even know if I can remember the titles, like Tender Thighs, maybe. It's not really known if Nabokov knew about Gerodius's reputation. He did have a sense of what it meant to be published in Paris because of the publication of Ulysses in the 1920s. Maybe he thought Gerodias would, and that Paris publication would give him that kind of edge that would promote the book and also link him to the tradition of the great Ulysses being published in Paris. It came out, it was controversial, it was somewhat successful. And over the next 3 years, Nabokov, I argue, managed that association with the Paris publishers in order to get a New York publisher who could get behind the book and really promote it. And the success behind all of this is that Lolita becomes a best-selling novel on the best-selling lists and becomes financially quite rewarding for Nabokov, and he can end his teaching career and so on. But I talk about the ways in which Nabokov very strategically used that Paris address in order to land a kind of more respectable address. So using that disrespectability in order to engineer his respectability. And that's basically where I end the book, but I also try to make the connection between what's happening with Nabokov and the publication of Lolita, make that connection back to what's happening much earlier in the 1890s.
I just want to sort of back up for a second, something I didn't ask you a few mm-hmm. minutes ago that comes up. I think you talk about it in the introduction and then in the section on pornography, you know, you're using this term that is so contentious. Well, it's not just you that's using it. I mean, you're talking about it historically and the way that it has been used. And I just wondered, you know, whether in any kind of conversation with feminist scholarship, or certainly when you're talking about a novel like Lolita, that there is all of this kind of, there's a politics to all of the material and the way that we think about the material that you write about in the book. And I just wondered how you negotiate that through the book, either by looking at these terms from a more genealogical perspective or historical perspective, or, you know, how you engage those political issues that come up in terms of interpretation and reading and thinking about this history.
Mm-hmm. The word pornography in particular?
Yeah, that or just that there is a whole literary history of kind of thinking about the moral politics of this material. And yeah. I just wonder whether that came up for you in writing the book.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I use pornography. Pornography is the term I use, though that term has fluctuated historically. But I do just stabilize the term and establish that that is the term that is most often used to describe sexually explicit material meant to arouse. It does have a very complicated genealogy and all sorts of redefinitions that mm-hmm. surround it, partly because people are uncomfortable with the word. But I just take ownership of the word, mm-hmm. and it's the label that was attached to Suburban Souls, Teleny, and Lolita, and at the time as well. So I stabilize that term in my discussion, and partly so that I'm not shy about talking about what is immoral, culturally reprehensible, illegal. So in Lolita, child rape. In some of Carrington's other works, there's a focus on incest. There's a focus on other taboo subjects, mm-hmm. Such as his sexual fantasies around slavery that appear in some of his publications. And I certainly am confronted by these representations and feel disgusted by them sometimes. And that's pornography's effect, to arouse, to discomfort. And I just feel that I'm not going to hide that away. And I also want to reveal the ways in which these figures I'm working on explore these topics and all of these topics are not recuperable ethically. But I think it's very interesting the ways in which these figures that I'm looking at and this literature that I'm looking at try to talk about the dirty secret of culture and reveal it and bring it out and in uncompromising ways so that it is visible, it is discussed.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that completely answers your question. I mean, it's the difficult question to answer.
Sure.
Some of this material is just, it's really hard to take, and it is not acceptable, but I think it is interesting to talk about.
Well, and I think, I mean, you have answered my question, and I think, and I guess some parts of that question remain open, but mm-hmm. I think that what you referred to earlier in terms of, you know, deliberately discussing a range of material that is not always put together, mm-hmm. and using that term pornography because it was the term that was used at the time, or that I think that has then the effect of us, you know, pushing us to sort of rethink the history of high modernism, as you say, yeah. and to think about those connections. So I think it's an incredibly productive effect of the work that you've done here. Well, Colette, I've taken up a lot of your time, and there's one final question that I'd like to ask you, which is, what are you working on now?
Ah, okay. Well, I guess I'm working on a few things, but my most exciting recent discovery has to do with a French library. And it was a library that was owned by the personal library of Guillaume Apollinaire.
Huh.
And it's intact. And it's at the Bibliothèque Historique de Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And it has all sorts of fascinating foreign language books, including English language books. Some of the books about which I've talked about in A Publisher's Paradise, but didn't know about, or didn't know about those editions when I wrote A Publisher's Paradise. And also, Guillaume Apollinaire was one of the first bibliographers of the Enfer collection.
Wow.
And so what that discovery has opened up is the whole history around the bibliography, the writing of the bibliography of Enfer, and all the work that went behind it, and all the discussions with other publishers and booksellers. So that's what I'm investigating next, to find out a little bit about the making of the bibliography of the Enfer collection and the story behind that.
That sounds incredible, and I hope that you'll come back and talk to me about it when it's in new book form. I just want to thank you so much, Colette, for joining me and for writing this rich book and bringing this history to light. You've been listening to New Books in French Studies. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll join us again next time.